Good evening, everybody. Just about time to get started here. Might be turning to the book of Leviticus. We're going to kind of pick up a little bit for just a few verses in chapter 7 as we dive in this evening. Kind of finish up our study on sacrifices. Been looking at quite a number of different kinds of sacrifices and what they're good for and all of the details around them. So we'll review that a little bit and then talk about the whole concept of what that means as we start moving forward into the Christian age and how those affect us. Before we start, I'm going to ask David King, if he would, to lead us in a word of prayer, please. Amen. All right. We've been looking at these sacrifices and studying how they fit in with the law that was given to Moses on Mount Sinai. Clearly, this was a very important part of the law and of the things that those people had to do in order to be in compliance with what God had told them. And as we think about the number of times that he goes through this, was another question this morning in class about forgiveness under the old law. And so we looked at this set of verses where just over and over and over again, God says, if you do these things, what's he going to do? He's going to forgive them. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes when we get to comparing some of the old and new. But clearly, you know, the expectation of someone going to the tabernacle and offering one of these sacrifices, and if they went through it and they were penitent and doing this in the way that God said, what was their expectation? That they would be forgiven. Why is that important? Think about it for a second from even our perspective. Why is that important?
I think because there was a path to forgiveness.
Okay. There was a path to forgiveness. The whole point is we want to be in a right relationship with God. Right? And we need somehow to understand that even though we are not perfect people, right? That everyone has problems. How did Paul say it? All have sinned, right? There's just no exception there. That we have a God who can forgive us, and therefore we do not bear the guilt any longer. And I've had opportunity this week even to understand what guilt can do to people. It drives you down. It can put you under. And what God has said is, I will have a path, all ages, all times, where you can be rid of the guilt. But now their path was pretty complex. And we've looked at a whole bunch of sacrifices. We've looked at the burnt offering, which was for general sin. And the sin offering down below is very similar, and the guilt offering together, sometimes it's kind of hard to distinguish those. They're called out, but a lot of the details are very similar. Peace offering, grain offering, all these different kinds of offerings, and each one had, you know, various things associated with it and what they were supposed to do. Things. As you think back on our study, first three chapters was looking at it from the priest's perspective, you know, his instructions. And then chapters 4 through 7 are kind of from the offerer's perspective. Here's some other details and things. There's some duplication of details in each place, and they're in slightly different orders. But each one of these is mentioned. As you kind of think back on that, what stands out? What stands out as takeaways for those chapters and those sacrifices? Okay, there's death and blood and a lot of it, right? What else? Okay, very particular about his requirements. Any question about what order to do things or where things should go or what they should do, right? Yeah, this was for everybody. This was not something that was just, you know, and even calls out. He goes, you know, especially if you look here at the sin offering, he's got, well, if you got a priest, you got this level. If you got a congregation, a leader, an individual, and he gets on down to just whoever, right? What else? The sacrifices had regulations based on without blemish, right? That they had to be the best. What else? Okay. Definitely there is implied repentance and willingness to do what God wanted in these, isn't there? A couple of more things, though. They cost them something, okay? The whole concept of sacrifice is that there was a cost involved, but the cost was always what? In proportion to what a person could pay, right? If God wasn't trying to put forgiveness into in some elite category where only those who could pay for it got it, unlike other ancient religions sometimes. And so as we look at all of that, and we think, okay, a lot of regulations, a lot of different kinds of sacrifices, he ends it up with a piece there in chapter 7, and it seems kind of out of place in a way, and yet it's one of those places where he's kind of setting a principle. Beginning in verse 22, and these sections are kind of set apart by this phrase. We've been talking in Sunday mornings on Galatians about being able to underline things and phrases and catchy things to be able to tell when you're making a new thought. Sometime when you're looking at Leviticus, just go through and look at the number of times it says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses saying," over and over again. Why do we see that phrase so much? Yeah, Moses is writing all this down, but whose will is it? It's God's, right? So it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, you shall not eat any fat from an ox, a sheep, or a goat. Also the fat of an animal which dies and the fat of an animal torn by beasts may be put to any other use, but you must certainly not eat it. Whoever eats the fat of the animal for which an offering by fire is offered to the Lord, even the person who eats it shall be cut off from his people. You are not to eat any blood either of bird or animal in any of your dwellings. Any person who eats any blood, even that person, shall be cut off from his people." So he's just right there in the sacrifices. All of a sudden, he's got these couple of other things he throws in. And there are times when the logic seems a little strange when you're flowing through it. But he's been talking about how they would butcher these animals and how they would do all of the disposition of the parts and pieces. And he goes, "Oh, yeah, let me remind you. No fat." I don't think he's talking about every little minuscule piece. There's some people who take this to an extreme in the way they carve things up. But there are fatty parts of an animal, right? And he's saying, nope, none of those. But what was the other restriction? Where did the blood restriction come from? That was part of the Noahic covenant, okay, which is still in effect here when he told Noah. Why was the blood not supposed to be eaten? Life was in the blood. The blood, as Rob brought out earlier, with the blood and the death that was associated there, that was something that was symbolic. Now, there are people who have looked and tried to put, you know, health regulations and all kinds of other stuff in it. That wasn't their point, okay? The point was just God had set some things aside, and he set them as symbolic. We're going to see a lot of that in Leviticus. I mean, there's a point where it says, I mean, I'm probably in violation of the old law wearing this shirt, because it's cotton and polyester, and you weren't supposed to mix linen, you know, mix fibers when you're making garments. We'll talk about those when we get there. But here he says, okay, no fat, no blood. Then he finishes up, and he says, this is the law. These are the last couple of verses of chapter 7. He says, this is the law concerning, notice this, we've got the burnt offering, the grain offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering, the ordination offering, and the sacrifice of peace offerings, which the Lord commanded Moses at Mount Sinai in the day that he commanded the sons of Israel to present their offerings to the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai. Once again, that's 6 different kinds of offerings there, right? He's saying, yeah, we've got a lot of details there. We've got to work on them. How many offerings do we have today? 1 Now, it also talks about other sacrifices that we make, right? Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. The the fruit of the lips as a sacrifice. There's other things that are involved in what we're supposed to do, but in terms of the blood part, there's just the one, right? Well, I want to take a look at that for today's class. Whoops. I put this picture up there because it's kind of interesting. When we start looking at the cross and what it means. This is a Celtic cross in Ireland. And one of the, I think that one was at Glendalough anyway. I'll find out later. I can't remember. Monasterboice. It was Monasterboice. Anyway, you notice it's hard to see on there, but there's all kinds of carvings and things on this. This was their PowerPoint. Okay? Because each one of those little blocks is a scene, in this particular one, from something relating to the arrest, trial, and crucifixion of Jesus. And so this was to remind them as they were looking at these. But as we start thinking about the sacrifice that Jesus made, please turn over to Hebrews, the 10th chapter. And let's look at a couple of verses there. In fact, I'm going to need some readers. I'm going to read this one, but I've got a lot of verses there, and I'd like to get some people to help me read here. So let's first start with Hebrews chapter 10. I put my marker in the wrong place. There we go. We just finished Hebrews, so hopefully this is still a little familiar to you. But he says here, by this will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Every priest stands daily ministering and offering time and time the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. Now, you might look at that and you go, well, we were just talking about the fact that these sacrifices, they were forgiven. So do we have a contradiction here between what he says in Hebrews and what he says in Leviticus? You have to keep going. Because he says, but he offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time onward. And for one offering, he is perfected for all time, those who are sanctified. And as you go through and looking at it, he's saying, if the old ones had been able to take away sin in a sense that the new one has, what would be the difference? Well, then he said they'd only have to be offered once, right? It wasn't they didn't forgive the sins. It wasn't that it wasn't a solution. It wasn't the solution. Point is, if they sinned again right after sacrifice, what'd they have to do? Go offer another sacrifice. What's different between that and the sacrifice of Christ? One for all. And so we have this sin offering that's been given on our behalf. Look over at the 13th chapter. Who's got that for me? Hebrews 13, verses 10 through 15. Go ahead. Okay, I love the symbolism that he's using here, and he's referring back to this sin offering, right? What happened to the sin offering, remember? The parts and pieces, they had to be taken outside the camp to burn. He says, just like that, what do we have to do? But we got to get outside the camp. What do you think he's meaning there with the symbolism? What does he tell us we have to do? Okay, that's certainly one of the things we have to do. But in this verse, he says, we have to go where? Outside the camp to Christ, right? We have to go to him. Christ already did his part. But does that mean that there's nothing left for us to do? We have to go to him. We have to go and understand that his offering was a sin offering on our behalf. And that's part of what we acknowledge when we're buried with him in baptism, right? And accept this blood that was offered on our behalf as a sin offering. And so he became our sin offering, offered once for all for sin, right? So, was there a sin offering for us? Absolutely. They had lots of sin offerings back then. And I think what you're going to see as we go through here is there's this unifying theme, right? That Christ fulfilled each of these roles, all in one package, in terms of the way that he interceded for us. How about a guilt offering? Didn't see a specific reference to that in the New Testament, and yet we got this wonderful passage in Isaiah 53 where it talks about the coming Messiah, right? Somebody read that, Isaiah 53 and verse 10. What does it say? Go ahead.
Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put it to grief, but his soul makes an offering for guilt. He shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper.
Okay, so what was the offering for there? For guilt. We talked about that a little earlier, right? How important it is that we understand that we can leave our guilt. And I think for a lot of people, it's very difficult, isn't it? For a lot of people, that's a difficult thing because it's hard for us sometimes to think of the terms that of whatever we've done that we understand was wrong and that in many cases we're ashamed of, that God could actually forgive us. But here, that's what he's saying, right? And he says, I will forgive, and you don't have to bear the guilt. Somebody else did that. Now, consequences are a different thing, are they not? And so sometimes when we start looking at this, that's where people get confused a lot of time, is understanding the difference between guilt and consequences. So, when the people rebelled against God, as they were getting ready to go into the land of Canaan, and they sent the spies out, and they came back, and we had 2 good reports and 10 bad reports, and they all kind of threw up their hands and went, you know, we can't do this. God was ready to literally destroy the whole lot of them, right, other than a few he was going to set aside. What did Moses say? He interceded. He said, please don't do it. And there's an interesting thing there, because the Lord comes back and he says, I have forgiven them according to your asking. They weren't going to bear the guilt of that rebellion. But then what happened? But you're all going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years until you're all dead. Okay? So were there consequences to that action? Yes, there were. Do we see that today? People can be forgiven of sins, but sometimes the consequences of sin are going to hang around. And that's one of the things that we have to understand as well, that what God is offering is freedom from guilt, not freedom from consequences. Okay, so we have a peace offering. Look at Romans 5, first 11 verses. Who's got those for me? Go ahead. Okay, what's the whole point of that passage? We have peace with God. And I think that's really the point that Paul is trying to make there when he talks about this reconciliation. What was the whole point of a peace offering? A peace offering was to ensure that there was peace between whom? you and God, right? Between God and man. That was the whole point of the peace offering. So now who's given the peace offering? Once again, Jesus has, right? And so this whole concept of trying to get back together with God, Jesus said, not only am I going to be the sin offering, not only am I going to be the guilt offering, I'll be the peace offering as well. Exactly. In case you didn't hear, Greg was bringing it up, when Jesus was born and the angels declared, you know, glory to God in the highest and peace. But was that like end of wars? No. That was the beginning of what was going to be ultimate peace between God and man, right? And so this peace offering was an important part of that. But also the firstborn, the first fruits. We see that in a couple of cases. Look over in Hebrews, the first chapter. Somebody read verse 6 for me. Hebrews 1, 6. Okay, so he brought his firstborn into the world for what purpose? What did Jesus say he came for? So you can save the lost by doing what? By dying. That seems kind of a strange way to seek and save the lost from our perspective, right? And yet he said, that's what I'm doing. That's why I'm going to Jerusalem. That's why I came. And he was God's first fruit offering, was he not? And he said the firstborn. How about Revelation 1, verses 4 and 5? I love the way that the when you look at Revelation, when it talks about who this book is from and how it characterizes Jesus. Revelation 1, 4, and 5. Who's got that for me?
John to the seven churches which are in Asia. Grace to you and peace from him who is and who was and who is to come and from the seven spirits who are before his throne and from Jesus Christ, the faithful witness, the firstborn from the dead, and the ruler over the kings of the earth, to him who loved us and washed us from our sins in his own blood.
Okay, so we got firstborn being used in a slightly different context there, don't we? What's he saying? He's firstborn there in what sense? Firstborn from the dead. Now, that's kind of an interesting statement. Were there not other people? I mean, hey, there was Lazarus, right, that was raised before that. So what does he mean, firstborn from the dead? And still living, right? Every other instance of someone that was raised from the dead in either the Old or the New Testament, what eventually happened to him? They died again. I've often wondered if Lazarus was, you know, a little bit peeved at being brought back. It's like, I was in a really good place and you had to pull me out of there. But he would die again, right? In fact, they were wanting to kill him again. Jesus said, he's firstborn from the dead in what way? Came back never to die again. So in the sense that God's firstborn, firstborn from the dead, Jesus filled that role of the first fruits for us. So in each of those sacrifices, there's lots of other references we could look at, but I think when you see those echoes in the New Testament, you kind of have to think back on all the what is involved in these other sacrifices, the details and the blood and everything that was going on, to say all of that was a shadow, just a mere shadow. And that's the way it's portrayed in Hebrews of what God had planned. And so we're sitting on this side of the cross, which as much as I love the old law, I'm really glad to be on this side of the cross. Where we can at least understand that. We need to understand that. But we have the superior sacrifice that was offered for us. But I think looking at these old ones, doesn't that kind of help you give you a little bit of a sense of what Jesus was filling in for? But there's one more. It's not mentioned in Leviticus, but it's in the book of Numbers. If you look at Numbers 19, there's an interesting sacrifice there. That was called the red heifer. Now, I just kind of wanted to throw this one in while we were talking about sacrifices and while we were talking about things that Jesus mirrored in these sacrifices. This sacrifice was really interesting. They had to seek out through the land. And if you read in the old Jewish writings, the Mishnah and the Talmud, it talks about the fact that sometimes this search would take years. That they would be going and looking for the perfect red heifer. It had to be absolutely uniform in color. It had to be the right shade of red. It had to be the right size and age. It just was had to be perfect. And then they took this perfect animal, and Numbers 19 describes in great detail how they were to sacrifice it, burn it all down to ashes, and then collect those ashes and keep them. And then there were a number of circumstances where it talks about being washed, or when they're using hyssop and using that to sprinkle different things. The water there refers to the water of the ashes. It would be that they would take water and they would mix in some of the ashes of the red bull, and then they would use that in a cleansing ritual. Now, many times, these were just for unclean things. One of the things we're going to find out as we keep studying in Leviticus is there's a difference between sin and uncleanness. Was it a sin to touch a dead body? No, it was not. I mean, you got to do that sometimes. The only time it was a sin was if, what did it make you if you touched a dead body? You were unclean, okay? And that helps us to understand this whole concept of holiness that God is talking about. You come in contact with them. There are a number of things where the cure for being unclean was to just wash with water. Sometimes there was things where you would go to the tabernacle and they would wash you with this particular, or sprinkle you with this particular water. And then a lot of times it was, and wait till evening. I've always wondered, at first I thought, why evening? Why not morning? But then I remembered, because evening and morning were the first day. Their day started at evening, right? So it was just, you're waiting till the next day, but it turns out that that starts at evening. And so you'd wait till the end of the day, and then you were ceremonially clean again. It only became a sin as if you were unclean, and you went to participate in any of these ceremonies and things at the tabernacle. Because if you were unclean, you were not to be before God. And so there was this clean, unclean. Well, these ashes of this red heifer were designed to go through this ceremonial cleansing. And the idea was, even though you hadn't sinned, you wanted to be in a state of holiness before God. And understand that you live in a world. Do we just get contaminated by the world sometimes? I mean, all you got to do is turn on TV and you're going to get contaminated, I guarantee you. And isn't there a sense in which you just want to be kind of washed of all of that and be clean before God? And so they had this similar kind of thing. It's just, we need to be clean before God. Well, if you go over to Hebrews, the 9th chapter, somebody take read me Hebrews 9, verses 11 to 14. Go ahead, David. Okay, find it interesting in those passages that he even links those things together with this. First, all of the sacrifices that Jesus represents there. And he says he offered his own blood for those, right? And yet then he comes around and he says, and the ashes of the heifer. I want you to think about something. The red heifer was the only sacrifice that was done ahead of time. And they took the ashes from it to work for the ceremonial uncleanness. Those ashes would last a long time. The Jewish writings say that they were able to salvage some of the ashes of the red heifer from the temple when it was destroyed in 70 AD, and those lasted for approximately 100 years. They were able to stretch them out before they ran out of them. And then they were really sad because they didn't have a temple anymore to go sacrifice and get another one, right? So now what are they going to do? It's just so many things that point to the end of the old law right there at this point, you know, when they were no longer able to carry out these instructions anymore. So we have Jesus filling the role of every kind of sacrifice that we see in the book of Leviticus. But that's not the only echoes that we're going to see. Any questions on this as we start next section here, looking at sacrifices and those things? If you have any other questions, please feel free to get me. Yeah, Joe. Mm-hmm.
They don't do this.
Correct.
They kind of do a modified whatever they do.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't follow the old law.
That is correct. One of the things that happened, and sometime if you want we can do a little bit more detail on it, but there were a couple of rabbis right after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem who realized that in order for Judaism to survive, they were going to have to figure this out. And so when they looked at things like the Babylonian captivity, they were unable to offer their sacrifices and things during the captivity. And so what substituted for that, and you can see it in the book of Daniel, what did Daniel do that kept his faith and his ethnicity, his Jewish ethnicity, separate from the Babylonians?
Diet
was one thing, and what was the other thing?
He prayed,
okay, openly, three times a day, facing Jerusalem, okay? So he did things that separated them, but was he able to offer sacrifices during that time? He wasn't able to. Well, modern Jews consider, from 70 AD till now, sort of the equivalent of the Babylonian captivity. That one day, they'll rebuild the temple on the Temple Mount, and then they can pick up where they left off. I don't know that I've ever heard any of them tell me what the lesson is. they're just in this state of persecution, and a lot of them see it that way. Now, there's a lot of other things that are problematic, even with that view, right? Who could serve as, and that's our next section, we're going to talk about the priesthood in Leviticus. Who was the high priest, the first high priest? Aaron. What was the qualification for being a high priest? Direct descendant of Aaron. How many of those do we have today? Who knows, right? We just don't know because the genealogical records were all destroyed. Well, that's going to be really hard when it comes time to reconstitute the temple and get the Levites going and whatnot. One of the things that when Jeroboam and Rehoboam, the split that was there, and I'm reading, daily reading, I'm just heading through that area right now, and it's kind of interesting because I caught again where Rehoboam, one of the things that he was called out for, I mean, I'll get him backwards here, Jeroboam. Jeroboam was the one who made the idols in the two places. One of the things that he was called out for was he let anybody be a priest. He didn't confine it to the Levites. I'm sure that made him very popular. Because there were others who would have liked to have been priests, right? But they weren't of the tribe of Levi, and so they couldn't be. But he was called out for it.
I can't remember it as a kid, but was it Paul that said, you know, if you're going to keep it, or that you keep it perfectly?
Absolutely. If you're going to keep it, you got to keep it. Now, they had circumstances like the Babylonian captivity, but how are you going to put this back together? The whole point is it's been dismantled. You know, 70 AD, dismantled the old law. We just need to understand that. Does that help, Joe?
Yeah.
So they've worked around it because otherwise you would have to admit that you just can't do it anymore. So they work around it. All right. So let's go on. The next section that we're going to look at is basically in the 8th and 9th chapters, there's this big ceremony that they're going to go through, consecrating the priests. And then it's going to talk about Nadab and Abihu in the beginning of the 10th chapter. And then the last of the 10th chapter is going to be just on the priests and their duties and their portions. So that's kind of the next big section here in the book of Leviticus. We've got just a few minutes, so I want to start talking first about just kind of keep in mind where they were doing their stuff. We got this tabernacle layout, and it's 100 cubits long. How long is that? Cubits about 18 inches. So the outside fence there is about 150 feet. Okay? That's kind of half the length of a football field, right? Football field is 100 yards, I think. I'm not a big football fan, so I don't know. How wide is it? It's 50 cubits wide. So that's like 75 feet. So it's not a small area. And it's curtained off with a curtain that's essentially 7.5 feet tall. White curtains all the way around it. And then on the inside, right there near the gate area, and this is the facing east is where the gate would be, another big set of curtains, but their difference was they were embroidered. You could tell where the front was because it was fancy. And then there's the altar right there. And this altar is a pretty good size. It's 5 cubits by 5 cubits. We talked about that before. 7.5 square feet, and it's about 5 feet tall. So pretty good size thing there, and something's burning on it all the time. So there's smoke coming up out of this thing. And then there's this laver, which was a big bronze thing that had lots of water in it. Now, it turns out that, how do you get the water in it? You haul it there with buckets. I mean, that's basically what you got to do, right? So we got people hauling water, hauling wood. There's lots of activity going on in this place. Right behind that is where the tabernacle proper starts. And in this area, those who were offering the sacrifices and those who were bringing, working through the specific sacrifices, they could be in that area. Who was allowed inside the actual tabernacle? Priests and Levites. Once in a while, there's a specific thing where somebody would be brought into that first area, but mostly that was the domain of the priests and the Levites. How about this last section? There's another curtain across here, and inside of here, we got a table of showbread. We got another little altar, which is an incense altar. There's the menorah, the branched candlestick that's there. That's what's providing the light. You remember they burned olive oil in it, but it had to be very pure olive oil. You can imagine in a case like that, you wouldn't want something that had much of a smoke emission, right? I mean, you're in a tent. So they're trying to keep it clean on the inside as well by what they've got. And then back here is the Ark of the Covenant. How many people get to see the Ark of the Covenant? High priest. How often? Once a year. And yet that was the mercy seat. That was the symbol of the presence of God. So clearly there's this veil there. There's some separation going on. So look at the layers between God and the people. There's some symbolic separation there, is there not? And we're going to put some gatekeepers in place. Who's responsible for maintaining this separation? So we got Levites on the outside, and it turns out they're camped all around this place. And then it talks about arranging the camps of the other people, and they're, each tribe's 3 to the north and 3 on each side and whatnot. But you can think of this as kind of the middle layer of Levites, priests right there on the inside, and then everybody else. Got some more layers there, all between the people and their God. So, again, lots of details, lots of symbolic things here going on. And then he starts out and he says, we're going to consecrate the priests. And that's what we start with in chapter 8. Now, a lot of the details for this are actually given over in Exodus 28 and 29 in terms of what the priests are going to wear, what the ceremony is going to be. And this part in Leviticus here, kind of presupposes that you know this stuff from Exodus. So you might want to glance over there and just kind of read through that as you're reading through this part. But I want to think just first about why in the world are we going to go through a really elaborate ceremony? We'll walk through this next week, but I want to talk about this for a couple of minutes we have left. Why a big elaborate ceremony? What's that? Okay, clearly it's public. We want the people to see this.
Ceremonies have messages. Why do we have the Lord's Supper every Sunday?
Okay, we attach ceremony to things that are important or that we want people to remember. Why do we have wedding ceremonies? Now, clearly royal wedding ceremonies are over the top, right? Mostly to show people how much money they have. But and yet, even for anyone that's going to get married, there is a marriage ceremony. What do you do during this marriage ceremony? Okay, it's a point of commitment, right? And why most of them are public? Why is that? You got witnesses. You want people who say, "Yep, I saw that." What else? Okay, there are, in a lot of the ceremonies, there's some underlying assumption of a relationship that's going on. In the military, does the military have ceremonies? You guys have been in the military. A lot of you have. What kind of ceremonies? What's that? Okay, there's change of command.
Retirement.
How about every day? What do you do in the morning? There's the right flag raising, right? What about at night? Yeah, get to lower the flag, right? And I remember, you know, when I'd be on base, the first time I was on base when all this is going on, everybody just comes to an absolute standstill. And I wasn't in the military, and I was like, "Oh wow, okay, you know, this is the rules. You you start hearing the music, everybody stands still and faces wherever the flag is, right? Why do you do that? That's a public ceremony, right? Why do you do that?" Okay, does it make you remember who you are, where you came from, what your job is, who you owe respect to, right? That's ceremony. That's why it's there. That's why it's important. So what are we going to do when we're going to invest those who are going to be the spiritual leadership for the community? We're going to go through a ceremony. Yeah. Yeah.
At the entrance to the tent of meeting, is that the entire nation?
Yeah, likely those words are used quite often in some other contexts. What would likely be the case there is the elders of the tribes and things like that would all be gathered in close, and they would fill probably that inner court area, and then there would be spill out into the outer. And in this particular case, I bet you there's people on the sides of the hills. There's, you know, whatever elevation they can get to look down into it. So it was open and public, but there were representatives that were there for the people. Now, what would have been those representatives' job, the ones that were close? They're going to go back and they're going to tell everybody else what they saw, right? So that's the way it was organized. But the whole point of tell the whole congregation to gather was, this was something that was done very publicly. We have some writings that are similar to it in the Mishnah and the Talmud where they talk about the Day of Atonement as it happened in Jerusalem. Because most of the ceremony is going on in the temple complex, right? But what happened was is they would have people stationed who would relay what was going on. And the whole city would basically be at a standstill during the entire day while this is going on, and people would be passing on, you know, "Oh, they're washing them now, you know, oh, now they're doing this," and then there would be trumpets blown at certain points so that they would know, you know, punctuating what was happening. And then when the priest would come out, his last thing that he would do would be to bless the people on that day, and that would, the picture I have in my mind is like a ripple. Because everybody got down and prayed. And so you can see this sort of respect that would be for the whole congregation. Even though, how many people that are sitting on the wall are going to be able to see anything? No. So were there a lot of people gathered who really didn't see it? Probably so. But the point was is that they would have been informed, and it would have been public, and the word would have gone out, and they would have all known what was going on. So it's a big deal ceremony. And so we'll start talking about that next week.